Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
For those of you who are joining us in your class schedule for the first time this week, let me introduce the series as well as our speaker. In 1926, Dallas Seminary established the W.H. Griffith Thomas Memorial Lectureship in honor of William Henry Griffith Thomas, one of the founding fathers of the seminary. Over the years, the academic departments have taken turns inviting prominent scholars to deliver the lectures that are designed to be a scholarly treatment of significant issues in their field of study and vocational experience. One of the purposes of the lectureship is to provide the seminary community with an exposure to a variety of scholars from different theological perspectives, yet all within the evangelical Christianity movement. This year, the Theological Studies Department has invited Dr. Albert Moeller as our guest speaker for this week of extended chapel lectures. Dr. R. Albert Moeller, Jr. serves as the ninth president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has been recognized for influential publications such as Time, Christianity Today, as a leader among even American evangelicals. You may have seen him on such programs as Larry King Live and others. In addition to his presidential duties, he hosts a daily live nationwide radio program on the Salem Radio Network. He also writes a popular blog and regular commentary on moral, cultural, and theological issues. He's a theologian as well as an ordained minister, having served as a pastor and staff minister of several Southern Baptist churches. He serves as a professor of Christian theology at Southern Seminary as well. He and his wife Mary have two children, Katie, who is at Union, and Christopher. He has had a disquieted night, obviously, and our own CFO, Rod Bryant's daughter, Becca, is a student there, and so all of us have been concerned. But Dr. Moeller, we are glad to have you this week. We appreciate your preparation, the insight, as you continue your lectureship series with us. Would you join me in welcoming again Dr. Albert Moeller?
Thank you so much, and President Bailey, faculty, students, again, it is a high honor to be among you and to be invited to present this lectureship. I hold your president and this faculty with such high esteem, and in so doing, I joined the larger evangelical community. I was pondering just last night, before I had to ponder so many other things, what would our libraries look like if all the Dallas authors were removed? You have made such a massive contribution, and I come here with a real sense of thanksgiving for who you are and what this institution is and has been for so many years. It was a long night last night, and those of you who are parents will understand how and why. You discover a lot of things. For one thing, you are reminded that when all the power goes, so do the cell phones. And thus that lifeline that usually lets you be in immediate contact leaves you actually with more anxiety than ever before. But it was a reminder also that last night my main concern was not the new atheism, but the eternal theism. And thanks be to God, all of the students at Union University were preserved, although some were injured. But there were many who awakened this morning to homes destroyed and to families with missing places. And thus, we pray, which would make absolutely no sense if there is no God to hear and if there is no God to act for his own glory and out of his mercy. Yesterday, I discussed secularism as an end game and secularization as a sociological process that has changed the conditions of belief. And I would suggest to you that as evangelicals, as theologians, and as pastors, as all those who care about biblical truth and the communication and inculcation of biblical truth, we better take seriously what it means for the conditions of belief to be changed, the mindset of a culture, because we are shaped by these certain structures of thought, as Peter Berger calls them, plausibility structures, that are prior to our thinking of other thoughts. Now, as I ended yesterday, having looked at the failure of the secularization thesis to explain all that would take place, we looked nonetheless at the affirmation of the secularization thesis in two specific dimensions. First of all, a geographical fulfillment of that theory in Western Europe, and then a demographic fulfillment of that theory within the intellectual and cultural elites. In other words, if you are in Western Europe, you do not doubt what the secularization process looks like. You have ancient cathedrals, generally in the center of almost every town of any size, large churches, but they are becoming secularized space because of a secularized mind and a secularized soul of Western Europe. Similarly, speaking in terms of demographics, if you are almost anywhere in the world a part of the self-referential academic and intellectual elite, you will notice the same phenomenon. Because it appears that the process of secularization has gone almost through its full development in those two dimensions. Now, it would be one thing to look at that missiologically and say, thus, we're looking at Western Europe as a great experiment in a post-Christian culture, a culture that was once Christian. And missiologists such as Leslie Newbegin point out that what we are learning for the first time in Christian history is what it means to evangelize a continent that perhaps has the liability of thinking that it has seen this before and heard all of this before. And thus, it believes it has moved past this. But similarly, we could look at it missiologically in terms of the academic elites and say, well, if we are going to focus on an intellectual engagement, a theological engagement, an evangelistic engagement with the elites, we want to keep this in mind. That is not the purpose of raising these issues today. It is to suggest that, especially looking at the demographic dimension of this, the intellectual and cultural elites, they play an inordinate part in influencing the larger culture. If indeed Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens were talking to each other, we would not be talking about them. But the reality is that something has happened that has created a cultural opening for the emergence of what we are calling the new atheism. This morning, we're going to be looking at the contours of this new atheism, but before we do that, we need to return to the issue of the conditions of belief to understand how this opening has occurred. I suggested that perhaps the most insightful philosopher in looking at this opening is Charles Taylor in his massive work, A Secular Age. It is a bold, but also a rather humble and honest work. Taylor, who has given attention to the secularization of society and to what it means to live in a secular age over the last several decades of his own work, has now turned to his magnum opus. And in this, he makes an argument that is very difficult to refute. His argument follows upon the analysis of others that when you're looking at the cultural elites and when you're looking at Western culture as a whole, certainly at Western Europe in particular, you're looking at the secularization of space, a space in which cognitively and rationally there is no need for God in the causal explanation or in the natural conversation of human beings. God becomes a symbol, if anything, a referent for that which was once believed. Now, in this work, A Secular Age, one of the gains we find is his analysis of three different stages, and this is very important. And I can summarize them this way, and I promise you that if you look at the size of Charles Taylor's book, you'll appreciate some summarization. Think in terms of three different phases that represent three different sets of conditions of belief. First, a situation in which it is impossible not to believe. Now, remember that he's not looking here into the souls of individuals. He's speaking about the contours of a culture. And if you go back into the medieval period and before that, if you go back to the Enlightenment, and especially before the Enlightenment, it was virtually impossible to find persons who did not believe or did not assume that belief in God was absolutely necessary to understanding the Weltanschauung, the worldview, or the world picture that was necessary to understand why the sun was there in the morning and the moon and the stars at night, why the world would make sense at all. This all required an understanding of God. In some sense, it was impossible not to believe because there was no other explanation. There was no other theory, there was no other rival worldview concerning how to explain all that human beings experienced. The second phase is when it is possible not to believe. If it was once impossible not to believe, then it becomes possible. And the Enlightenment, just in terms of historical analysis, becomes the great opening for this. Now, you'll remember from yesterday, I mentioned that in the English language, the word atheist was not even necessary until the 16th century. Even in the 16th century, it was very clear that this kind of atheism was a specific kind of atheism, which is to say, in the 16th century, if you were an atheist, you knew what you were an atheist about. It wasn't a general mood, it was a specific sense of rejection. But even then, in the larger culture, it was understood that it was, for most people, impossible not to believe. The Enlightenment, all of a sudden, with the great epistemological turn to the subject, when all of a sudden the individual becomes the center of meaning and the process of cognition itself becomes the great art and discipline, when God is no longer understood to be the subject, the sovereign subject, but is now the object of study, then the possibility of non-belief emerges. But we are not living now in the 18th century. We are living in the 21st century. Charles Taylor suggests that we have now entered a third stage of intellectual development in which we have moved from a time in which it was impossible not to believe to a time which, culturally speaking, it then became possible not to believe, to a situation which, for those in the elites especially, it is now impossible to believe. In other words, if you look at the contrast between the first stage and the third stage, it is an absolute reversal. In the first stage, there was no rival explanation for any reality, for life, for the past, for the present, for the future, other than Christianity, biblical faith. But if you look at the current stage, it is the reversal. Now there are not only alternatives to the biblical worldview that are available, these alternatives appear to be superior and as ensconced and situated as normative within the worldview of the culture, especially at the level of the elites, such that now belief in the actual revelation of God in Scripture, theism itself, becomes something of an impossibility. If unbelief, non-belief, was an oddity in the first stage such that it was considered eccentric, if not dangerous, so also we have to understand that in this third stage, theism is considered not only eccentric, but dangerous. That is the shift from the older atheism to the new atheism. The new atheisms in various authors and forms, and the new atheism as a movement suggests that theism is now not just something that we have moved beyond, not just something that we can put behind us as belonging to an infantile or adolescent period of human development, but now it is dangerous because people who believe in God are dangerous people who do dangerous things and are a dangerous toxin within the culture at large. Charles Taylor puts it this way. He says, belief in God is no longer axiomatic. There are alternatives. Now, when there are alternatives, people will take these alternatives. And as he points out, even to believe in God isn't quite the same thing in 1500 and in 2000. Very interestingly and tellingly, he points out that even to recite the same words in 1500 and in 2000 is not necessarily to repeat the same words in the same way, with the same meaning, with the same structure of thought. When we say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, in the year 2008, we are making a declaration. If we truly believe those words, as I certainly hope we truly believe those words, we are saying them knowing that if we are overheard in the society, people will hear us to be saying something that is not commonly believed, certainly among the elites. Whereas in the year 1500, to say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, was to say what made the entire civilization make sense. We are in a changed situation. It is good, important for us to know this. Now, this new situation, what Charles Taylor describes as this third stage, has provided the opening for the new atheism, and it is quite an opening. The opening is reflected in terms of media attention. The opening in terms of cultural attention is noted in terms of book sales. Now, there's a very interesting footnote here in terms of book sales in America. And as a matter of fact, the tripwire for this realization among booksellers was a book in which, of all things, there were hints of the new atheism to come. And this was Stephen Hawking's great book. It sold by the millions and millions and was read by the hundreds. And one of the most interesting things is that pollsters discovered that people admitted buying the book and never having read it. It became one of those books everyone had to have, apparently in order to appear sophisticated and cultured. You had to have it, but it was not necessary to read it. I said within the book there was a hint of the new atheism, and it comes where Hawking describes at the end how God might fit into his scheme. Some of you will remember this. He said God might exist, but we now know enough about the universe to know that if he does exist, there is nothing for him to do. In other words, an entirely naturalistic and mechanistic world picture has no need of God at any point. So anyway, when you're looking at the sales of these books in the millions, that does not necessarily mean the reading of these books in the millions, but nonetheless, it is an indicator of what persons think they ought to know and ought to have and ought to be conversant about. Now, looking at the new atheism, I want to speak specifically again of four figures: Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. And a part of what I hope might be helpful to you in these lectures is that you will be at least conversant with who these men are and what they are about. First, Richard Dawkins. He holds the Charles Simonyi Chair for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University, a chair that was established with a massive endowment in order to lure him back from the University of California at Berkeley, where he taught after receiving his Doctor of Philosophy degree from Oxford University. He was born in 1941 in Kenya to a rather well-established British family there in Kenya. Moved when he was about 8 back to Great Britain. He attended the normal schools there for the middle class in Great Britain, and then Balliol College, from which he received his undergraduate degree in zoology, and then from the university where he received his master's in doctor philosophy. He received the doctor of philosophy in 1966, the DPhil, and then went almost immediately to the University of California at Berkeley to begin teaching. He was lured back, as we said, to Oxford, and now holds one of the most famous chairs now in the entire university, one of the most funded chairs, and also has become probably the most recognizable scientist now in the world. In 1976, he wrote the book that established his mass reputation. It was entitled The Selfish Gene. And the particular part of evolutionary theory for which Richard Dawkins is now famous is his argument that the basic unit of natural selection is the gene. His argument, put in simplest form, is that genes exist in order to replicate themselves, and as replicators, they fuel the entire process of natural selection. Genes exist in order to replicate themselves in such a way that they will, for instance, like a virus, expand themselves. They exist only to replicate themselves and then to die, which is a not only rather sober understanding of life, but frankly, one that if you are committed to an evolutionary worldview, can make a great deal of sense. That's why he gained such an immediate scientific reputation. As a matter of fact, now at the high table, as it's called, of Darwinist theory, you basically have two rival understandings of the process of natural selection, and Dawkins' understanding of the selfish gene is now becoming the most dominant among them. This book, The Selfish Gene, however, was not written for the scientific community. Dawkins had already published his papers in peer-reviewed journals, and his research was well-known in that community. It was written for a mass audience, because even as he holds a chair, which is a chair for the public understanding of science, Richard Dawkins understands himself as an advocate, as an evangelist of sorts for evolutionary theory. He believes that an understanding of human evolution is absolutely essential to understanding where we are in the human prospect and how we should seize control of evolution looking to the future. He understands that evolution produces a worldview. It's the worldview that he believes is the only plausible worldview available to us. Now, Richard Dawkins is also well known among us because he has great facility with the media. He has a sense of humor. He is bright. He's obviously able to be very articulate in terms of the media environment. The media is attracted to him. And of course, he holds beliefs that are interesting to many of those who will be presenting such issues in the media. Now, the obvious implications of all of his worldview in terms of analysis of the selfish gene and the larger project of evolution, it raises obvious questions about God. And Dawkins reflects that these came to him as early as age 9 when he began to doubt As he was being catechized, he realized that he did not believe these things. Darwin, in 1856, wrote a letter to his friend Hooker in which he said, "What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blunderingly low, and horribly cruel works of nature." As Hobbes would describe nature, red in tooth and claw. Well, picking up from that citation from that letter, Richard Dawkins has declared himself the devil's chaplain. And he wrote a book by that title in 2003, dedicated it to his daughter Juliet, who was then 10. And in that book, he argues that evolution, in terms of its total understanding and its implications for the existence or non-existence of God, should now be publicly discussed. In an essay included in that book, written originally in 1993, entitled Viruses of the Mind, Dawkins, now, I guess about 15 years ago, first addressed himself to what he calls the fundamental virus of faith. Now, in the end of that book, The Devil's Chaplain, he addresses a letter to his 10-year-old daughter. The letter is entitled Good and Bad Reasons for Believing. Very interesting piece of parental advice. He suggests to his daughter, who was then 10, three bad reasons to believe in any proposition or truth claim. The first of these is tradition. And he says that this is especially important, and this will become key to Dawkins' later thought. He says that tradition is especially seductive because children are natural receptors of tradition. They find their identity from their parents. As parents tell the story, as they find themselves situated within tradition, they find their identity. This Dawkins finds to be very dangerous and seductive. He warns his daughter not to accept truth from tradition. Secondly, and equally perniciously, he suggests that another bad reason for believing is authority. In other words, just because someone says something is true is no reason to believe that it is so. The third bad reason for believing, he suggests, is revelation, which he believes is categorically impossible. Therefore, any claim to belief based upon revelation, he suggests, should simply be dismissed out of hand. Now, armed with that letter to his daughter, you can understand the inevitable atheism that would emerge from this. Notice that it is not agnosticism. The new atheists consider agnostics to be failed believers, not people on the way to atheism. They consider them to have a lack of will, specifically the intellectual will to draw thoughts to a proper conclusion. Now, Dawkins, after having identified faith as the fundamental virus, then turns to revelation, again, as the third reason not to believe. But he points out to his own daughter that the persistence of religious belief might be due to the fact that children, listen to this, have to be suckers for traditional information. Otherwise, they do not survive. Now, notice that this evolutionary mechanistic worldview applies now even to conversations between parents and children. Now, one of the other factors in Dawkins' thought is a word that he coined. Some of you have no doubt heard it, probably used it, meme, M-E-M-E, which he coined as a word for an intellectual unit similar to a gene that would explain the replication of thought. Memes are sets of ideas that are replicated in the society. He is suggesting that parents pass memes onto their children as well as genes. In 2006, he wrote the book that became his bestseller, this is just 2 years ago, entitled The God Delusion. It became his landmark bestseller, stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for a matter of months. We'll return to Dawkins shortly, but it's important to recognize that among the new atheists, he is the most persistent, and he is probably the best known and most read. The second of these figures is Daniel Dennett, born 1942 in Boston. He's a philosopher of mind and a philosopher of science. He's taught for almost the entirety of his career at Tufts University, where he directs the Center for Cognitive Studies and is the Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Philosophy. He received his BA from Harvard and his Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford 1 year prior to Dawkins receiving the degree in the same place. He has a career and a pattern of thought that's congruent with Dawkins, and he also insists, as his great life project, that evolution alone explains human consciousness. He insists that there must be a wholly empirical understanding of human consciousness, and that's what he is famous for in the scientific community. In 1992, much as Dawkins has sought to popularize his thought with the selfish gene, Dennett sought to popularize his empirical understanding of human consciousness in a book entitled Consciousness Explained. Now, that book became one of those very rare science books that actually sells. And it sold and gained a great deal of attention for his argument that human consciousness has to be reduced to a basically mechanistic and naturalistic understanding, purely empirical. Now, Dennett is absolutely committed to the worldview that evolution explains everything. Everything. In 1996, he published the book Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Now, I found that book one of the most seminal books in science I had read in many years. But, of course, it's not just about science. It's about theology. But Daniel Dennett's book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, comes down to this central point. He talks about his experience as a boy interested in science when he and a friend, aged about 12 or 13, invented the idea of a universal acid. Now, any of you who have ever been a 12 or 13-year-old boy will understand the attractiveness of such an idea. The idea of a universal acid is this. What if there were an acid that was so powerful that this acid would dissolve anything? No container could be found that could safely contain it. The acid would dissolve every container. No element could be found on Earth that could withstand it. What would happen? Well, eventually, the universal acid would destroy everything. Nothing would remain. A tantalizing thought to a 13-year-old boy, one that became a fuel for his intellectual development. Because when he discovered Darwinism, he said, I have now found the universal acid. His point is this. As an intellectual tool, Darwinism is just as corrosive and just as powerful as this hypothetical universal acid. It burns everything away. His suggestion is this. Put simply, once Darwinism is fully understood, every other truth claim will cease to hold power, will cease to have credibility, because Darwinism will be all that remains. Now, as a footnote here, let me suggest that that is a very helpful argument in order to set the reality before us. Those who try to find some way of finding a middle ground between the naturalist argument of Darwin and theism should listen to Daniel Dennett say, if you understand theism and you understand Darwinism, you'll understand they are fundamentally incompatible. He's absolutely certain that Darwinism will win the day. As he opens his book, he does so touchingly by reciting a Sunday school song that he learned as a little boy entitled, Tell Me Why. He recites it for us. Tell me why the stars do shine. Tell me why the ivy twines. Tell me why the sky's so blue, then I will tell you just why I love you. The answer is this, because he made the stars to shine, because he made the ivy twine, because he made the sky so blue, because he made you, that's why I love you. Daniel Dennett suggests that is a sweet, innocent, reassuring, and fundamentally wrong understanding of reality. He suggests that this indeed is a poetic, lyrical understanding of life, but then he says, along comes Darwin and ruins the picnic. He says this, almost no one is indifferent to Darwin, and no one should be. The Darwinian theory is a scientific theory and a good one, but that is not all that it is. The creationist who opposes it so bitterly is right about one thing. Darwin's dangerous idea cuts much deeper into the fabric of our most fundamental beliefs than many of its sophisticated apologists have yet admitted, even to themselves. There's absolutely no design, therefore there's no meaning in the universe. Absolute naturalism, fundamental materialism. If you're looking for meaning in the universe, stop. It isn't there. All that's left is Darwinism. In 2006, he wrote the book that establishes him as one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. It was entitled Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. Now, if you are pushing this new atheism, you need this. You need an argument that explains the persistence of religion. You need, if you are pushing a naturalistic worldview, someone to explain how religion is a natural phenomenon. Now, this is not an entirely new project, but Dennett is at the top of the game. The basic problem is this: how do you explain religion? It's one thing if you're following an evolutionary worldview to try to explain an appendage or an organ. It's another thing to try to explain something as persistent as belief in God, which, again, the worldview of these naturalists holds, is fundamentally wrong. Thus, how did it happen? Well, if you hold to his understanding that the mind is nothing more than a chemical machine, a neurological machine developed for the process of evolution, remember that much like Dawkins points to the selfish gene, and by the way, Dennett accepts the selfish gene theory, when you extend that out, then the entire human animal, the human being, exists for nothing more than the replication of genes. And so everything that is true about us is true because evolution has produced it in order to further the blind process of evolution. Natural selection explains that those who have larger brains have succeeded where those with smaller brains have not. Those who have the ability to walk have survived where those who had no such ability did not. Well, why did those who believe in God survive and supposedly those who did not survive? Well, if you hold to a purely natural understanding of religion, you have to say there must have been some evolutionary advantage at some point to believing in God. That evolutionary advantage might be that if you believe that there is life after death, you might live in such a way that you're more likely successfully to replicate your genes. Now, some of you right now are wondering how in the world that will preach on Sunday morning. And I promise you, it will not. But in a purely natural understanding of religion, you have to come up with something like this, that somehow religious belief, in particular belief in life after death, belief in a God, belief in an authority, and a belief in a revealed morality, belief in a divine judge, all of this must somehow produce replicators who replicate more successfully. Now, if you hold to this natural understanding of religion, then where does this take Daniel Dennett? It takes Daniel Dennett to this. Obviously, this mass belief in God points out that there must have been an evolutionary advantage somewhere back there, but not now. So, Dennett suggests, our great task in this generation is to rid ourselves of what was once an evolutionary advantage, but is now an evolutionary disadvantage. Now, Dennett, like Dawkins and others, holds to an absolute atheism. He holds to a very caustic form of this atheism, but he smiles where Dawkins frowns. Where indeed Dennett finds believers, he says, more or less, well, I understand that. It was inevitable. Evidently, at some point, it was important to our evolutionary advantage. I understand that. I understand you. But you need to get over it. There is no God, and now we don't need any more of your spawn. We don't need any more people carrying this meme of belief in God. So get over it. He suggests that religion is a social belief system, but it's very important. At least, again, these new atheists understand the theism they're rejecting. Listen to this. He says this. He says that true religion is found where participants avow belief in a supernatural agent or agents whose approval is to be sought. Now, that's important, again, because Daniel Dennett, just like Richard Dawkins, as we shall see, points out that liberal theology is, it's akin to agnosticism. As he suggests, this is Dawkins again, agnostics are failed believers. Liberal theologians, he suggests, are failed non-believers. That will hit some of you after dessert. Now, the other thing we have to gain from Dennett is that Dennett has created a new category, which is not just belief, but belief in belief. Now, this, I believe, can be helpful to us. Dennett suggests that the persistence of belief in God is not all that it's cracked up to be, because he suggests that if you actually scratch beneath the surface, fewer people believe in God than may first appear. Instead of believing in God, they believe in belief. In other words, they have a functional understanding of religion. They really are not claiming cognitively to believe in God, because as Dennett understands, if they really did, they'd have to live differently than they do. So instead, they actually believe in belief. Now, an example of this, which he doesn't offer, but which I will draw from history, is the Israeli Prime Minister, the late Golda Meir. Once she was asked if she believed in God, she said, "The Jews believe in God, and I believe in the Jews." That's belief in belief. In other words, the understanding that belief's important. I don't necessarily believe. I don't have to commit myself to the cognitive structure of thought. I don't have to confess or profess belief in God. All I have to do is believe in belief. Now, Dennett says, let's consider that that could be a stage toward the eventual ridding ourselves of the meme of belief in God. Maybe we can move from belief to belief in belief to no more needing even that belief. When you put Dawkins and Dennett together, you have two men who offer something of a 1-2 punch for the new atheism. They enter the conversation because both of them are absolutely convinced that the fundamental meaning of the universe has to be explained in purely naturalistic terms. Those naturalistic terms have to be encapsulated in the finest, most accessible theory available. That theory is, of course, that of Darwinism. Now, when we are speaking here of Darwinism, we're speaking of the dominant theory of evolution, which is now ensconced within the larger intellectual community. So you're not talking about just Darwin's own personal contribution, because evolutionary theory has moved far beyond that. But what we need to understand is that both Dawkins and Dennett are absolutely convinced, representing the scientific establishment, that there can be absolutely no reconciliation between naturalism and theism. They would argue that there can be absolutely no reconciliation between a belief in evolution and a belief in God. Dawkins, with a smirk, suggests that those who believe in God are wrong and dangerous and deluded. Dennett says, well, understand them. I mean, evolution is, by definition, a rather messy thing. And even as there are vestigial organs, who knows what the appendix was supposedly for from an evolutionary worldview, so there are vestigial beliefs. We should consider it success, Dennett says, that we have moved, in the case of many people, he says, just watch them, from belief to belief in belief. That's a stage, perhaps, toward ridding the human project of even belief in belief. Both Dawkins and Dennett then have to turn to the question of the young. And as we shall see tomorrow, both of them have proposals about how children are to be freed from the gene, or in better parlance, the meme of belief being replicated within them. When we're together next, we will look at Sam Harris and at Christopher Hitchens. We will also look closely at the distinguishing marks of the new atheism, which characterize its break from the old. And then, as the week comes to a conclusion, we'll consider what kind of theism is actually worth rejecting if you are a new atheist. The one great gain of the new atheism for our thought this week is that the new atheists actually understand what theism is. They know exactly what they are rejecting. God bless you.